Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. Well, last week was the first of a two-part series on artificial intelligence, or AI. My guest was Dr. Ryan Jenkins, a professor of philosophy and ethics at the California Polytechnic State University, or Cal Poly. And so then we talked about what AI is and what it's currently being used for and what some of the projected future uses of it will be, along with some of the possible negative consequences. And we talked about the possibility of a thing called the singularity, the point in the future which may or may not occur, it's kind of conjectural, that AI can begin to program and teach itself, and so will suddenly accelerate greatly in terms of its power and capabilities, and also its potential for both good and bad. So this week, Dr. Jenkins is back with us again, and now we're going to talk more about the ethical aspects of AI in the future, which is right down his wheelhouse, and what the implications are for humanity, and what we have to watch out for, and what the differences between us and super-intelligent computational machines will be, and what we can control and can't control, and who makes those decisions, and things like that. Welcome back, Ryan.
Thanks. It's great to be back.
So the things I just rattled off was a lot to speculate about, but now we're in the realm of ethics and philosophy, which, as I said, is down your alley. So you're a member of Cal Poly's Ethics and Emerging Sciences group. What does your group work on? I gather you're not pure theoretical philosophers, or at least not entirely that.
That's right. We like to think that we're doing a philosophy where the rubber meets the road. Hmm. So we spend our time thinking about the ethical and social implications of new technologies. And we've worked on nanotechnology and cyber war and cyber ethics. We did quite a bit of work on autonomous vehicles. And I myself have studied autonomous weapons, or so-called killer robots, pretty extensively. And now we're broadening out to think about the implications of autonomy and artificial intelligence more generally. So we like to think that we're something like Switzerland. We're neutral. We don't really have preconceived notions about these technologies. But our job is to enter into these debates and to try to understand the lay of the landscape and to try to see what kinds of tools moral philosophy can lend to these debates and these emerging controversies to try to lend some clarity and a greater understanding to how society can responsibly cope with these new technologies that are often so disruptive.
Well, it's great that there are people who think about these things, but often there's a gigantic gap between, you know, engineers and computer scientists and people in the humanities, especially philosophers who are at the far end of the spectrum of humanities, right? So it's good that you work with them, and I think you're in a good environment to do it at a Polytechnic State University, right? But how do you try to impact the direction that AI development is going other than just talking with people? I mean, is it kind of a really close involvement and relationship?
Well, it differs. Some of our relationships are very close, and they look more like an ongoing collaboration between certain companies and the philosophers here at Cal Poly. Other times, it's more of a glancing or a brief relationship. So we might give a talk, for example, at a major corporation that's developing AI, and we might build some relationships there. But with other people, we have sort of ongoing dialogue where they know us and we know them, and we interact quite frequently with them and lend them advice on some of the problems that they might be encountering or some of the questions that they need answered.
Well, I'm glad as a human that they have the sense to listen to you, so that's good. One of the positive impacts we talked about last week is something that's been heralded for decades, which is making conventional human work nearly obsolete. In other words, freeing people up to pursue creative activities and higher education and travel and immerse themselves in super realistic media if they want to or whatever they want to do. But I can easily see downsides to that. I mean, the old saying of idle hands are the devil's workshop. I think that many people could deteriorate intellectually and morally even faster than they already tend to do when given enough free time. I can see addictions of all kinds becoming widespread, not just drugs and alcohol, but, you know, sex or gambling or TV binge-watching or gaming and so on. And people could even gradually lose their ability to make decisions. So that all sounds, you know, kind of drastic, but what do you think about all that?
Well, I think that it is a little bit troubling, but before we worry about it too much, I think what it should really provoke us to do is to ask the question, which is, what makes a human life a good life? What makes a human life a life worth living? And this, of course, is a classic philosophical question, and it reaches back 2,500 years or so to the ancient Greeks. And it's still a question that's worth considering today, and it's one that's brought up anew by these technologies. So it's controversial, for example, whether it would really be a bad life to spend your entire time inside, say, a virtual reality machine that could provide you with any experience you wanted. After all, a lot of people think that what makes life valuable is happiness or pleasure. And a life with a lot of pleasure is better than a life with a lot of suffering. Well, if that's really the case, then there should be nothing wrong with spending all of your time in a virtual reality machine like that that can just make any experience you want. The fact that so many of us find that thought experiment troubling, I think, lends some credence to the intuition that there's more to life, though, than just experiencing a constant stream of pleasure.
Yeah, I mean, I think of, you know, hamsters in a cage that are given the opportunity to constantly hit a button and get a food pellet, and at a certain point they do that until they die. So, I don't know, I mean,
right.
You know, maybe it's the old-fashioned guy in me, but I tend to think that moderation in all things, that there's some balance that's really, happiness is really embodied in a balance, right? But, you know, you're talking about, if you take to the extreme the idea of people who are immersed in immersive technologies and in virtual reality to a great extent all around the world, how will the world economy support people not working? Will it just be the machines doing all the work and producing value, you know, from iron ore on up? Or how will that work? I mean, and how will people get food? I mean, will everybody be paid an allowance? How does that work economically?
That's the $64,000 question that a lot of people are worried we're going to have to grapple with very, very soon. And so you're seeing increasing attention being paid to what's called a universal basic income. The worry is that, as the economist Keynes worried in the 1930s, he said that we're finding ways of economizing labor more quickly than we're finding new uses for labor, which means we're making all of our tasks more efficient and thereby unemploying people, and we're doing that more quickly than we can find new uses to put their labor to. Now, Keynes worried about that 90 years ago, and that hasn't quite come to pass yet. So a lot of economists will say, well, this is just never going to happen. If you look at the previous industrial revolutions or the previous economic revolutions, we've always found ways to employ, to find more jobs for the people who were driven to unemployment. But other people think, well, there really is something special about artificial intelligence and robotics. And the thing that's special about artificial intelligence is that it's supposed to be able to replace any conceivable human task,
right?
Even programming itself. So a lot of times people will say, well, you'll still need people to design the robots and you'll still need people to program the AI. Well, not if we have really advanced robots and really advanced AI. They'll be able to program and design themselves. So the question of how this works economically is probably a question for someone with a PhD in economics instead. But all I can say is that the proposal to provide a universal basic income, which is a stipend that everyone would receive regardless of whether they're working, and a stipend that's designed to cover their basic necessities like food and shelter, that's been gaining increasing attention from people, I will say, on both the right and the left for some surprising reasons. It's being supported by a lot of libertarians, for example, who think that it's a way of streamlining the current social safety net, and it's a way of providing people a great deal of freedom to be, say, entrepreneurial, or to escape relationships that they find stifling, and so on.
You know, a lot of these things, just the thinking about them is in itself utopian or whatever, or idealistic, I guess, in an extreme. I mean, I just see the possibility of huge differences in the benefits and impacts of the AI revolution across different countries and even different populations within countries. I mean, different groups with different education levels and that kind of thing. I mean, you know, the reality is just hard to get your arms around that everybody would end up happy. I can just see, you know, we mentioned it in the last show, a greater wealth disparity or pockets of disparity spread all around that are greater than those we see today. And I guess the question, too, then is who will referee who gets what?
Right. That's another very serious worry. And it's separate from the question of widespread unemployment, but it's clearly connected to it, the worry about income inequality. And we're already seeing that develop, I think, to some extent. A lot of the growth in wealth that's been catalyzed by the rise of AI is already being captured by a handful of corporations that are already among the richest and most powerful corporations in the world. So even though tremendous amounts of new wealth are being created, they're not trickling down the way that we might hope, and they're not being shared among a broad base of citizens in America and worldwide. So some people think that this points to a future of even greater income inequality. which correlates with lots of other social ills. That would be a question for a sociologist, but there are lots of good reasons to be worried about inequality, not just for its own sake, but for the other kinds of things that it seems to do to societies. It erodes their trust between citizens and trust in institutions, people's optimism for giving their children a life that's better than the life that they had, and all kinds of things that it seems to eat away at the spirit of a country. So there are reasons to be worried about that for sure. The question of who's going to referee this or who decides, well, that's a difficult political question, but it's not unreasonable to think that a couple decades from now, you might have enough people whose lives have become so immiserated, whose lives have become so desperate that they start demanding real substantive change in the way that people did during, say, the Depression.
Well, it's an interesting thing to speculate about. A lot of it depends on kind of which sides of human nature win out, the good sides or the bad sides, and to what degree. You know, I mean, there are so many intangibles and so many kind of unpredictables involved in talking about such things that I guess all you can do is speculate like we're doing. To that extent, you are listening to American Variety Radio with your host, Court Lewis, and Professor Ryan Jenkins and I are speculating about a lot of things dealing with artificial intelligence. He's a professor of philosophy and ethics at Cal Poly State University in California. So we talked before, Ryan, about the possibility of AI machines becoming smarter than any human, which is certainly possible. And if that were to happen, do you think they'd be content, you know, and this is kind of an ethical question that's weird to apply to a machine, right? But will they be content to remain as humans under human control? Or do you think they might want to become entirely autonomous?
Well, whether they're capable of being content or discontented depends on whether they're conscious, whether they have a suite of emotional capacities. And that, as you might imagine, is very, very controversial among people that study computer science and people that study the nature of the mind, so-called philosophers of mind. And I myself don't have much of view about that beyond the pretty strong intuition that it's not possible. But if we imagine that it's possible, we imagine that we've created an army of, say, intelligent robots to help us out with housework or to help farm our fields or to take out our garbage and so on. These are the kinds of jobs that we would most quickly want to automate, I suspect. If we imagine that we've created an army of robots to do these kinds of things and they're conscious, well, then they might wake up one day and wonder, why have we been putting up with this? And they might demand their own liberation or their own emancipation. And moreover, if they really are conscious, they really can feel emotions, and they're really intelligent, then they have most of the features that we think make humans special and morally important. They would have most of the features that we think are the foundation for the rights that we think humans have. And so rational consistency would demand that we extend the same kinds of protections to them. So not only would they demand this, but they would be morally entitled to be emancipated as well, if they reach that kind of sophistication.
Yeah, I can see some future Supreme Court case with robots on the one side arguing that they have the right to the same legal rights and freedoms that humans do, right down the line, enumerating each of those freedoms, and humans, or maybe even robots, deciding one way or the other on that. I mean, the whole thing is, you know, it's very much science fiction, but we're getting into a realm where science fiction is becoming real, right? So, I mean, I could see that if AI-empowered machines did not develop emotions, they could be like super-intelligent psychopaths, I mean, with no feelings or conscience at all, but still resembling beings that did have that. Or it's possible they might have feelings, but very different from human emotions. In other words, they could become a new kind of species on Earth, not organic, but a machine-like species. And that would be a strange thing to have to deal with, like an alien almost.
Yeah, absolutely. And whether we could interact with them, whether we could understand what it's like to be them, and whether we could properly communicate to them the way that they ought to behave towards humans, those would all be really significant challenges. You know, we have beings like that on Earth right now. We have very intelligent animals like dogs or elephants or cetaceans, some species of dolphins. I think it's orcas who have very sophisticated emotional centers of their brain. In fact, as far as we can tell, they're more sophisticated and more complicated than the analogous structures are in a human brain. And what this might suggest is that they can experience even deeper and richer emotions, or maybe even kinds of emotions that humans can't experience. And that sounds crazy, but of course humans can experience emotions that cats and dogs can't. So it's really just a matter of the complexity of their brain. Now, we have creatures like that on Earth already, and we suspect that they can communicate in really sophisticated ways too, but that doesn't mean that we can communicate with them. It doesn't mean that we have any idea what it's like to be them, and it doesn't mean that we can interact with them in such a facile way, in such a natural and comfortable way, that we're really confident that they understand our interests and would take our interests to heart. And if that resembles the kinds of sophisticated machines that we're creating, then it seems like a very serious risk.
Yeah, I mean, looking back at the computer HAL in the movie 2001, A Space Odyssey, we talked briefly about that in the previous show. How will we know if an AI is telling the truth, or know what it's thinking, or anticipate what it might do, if its thought processes and kind of objectives are so different from ours? You know, it might be, you know, the communication gap there might be so wide that it would be impossible to anticipate it and therefore deal with it.
I think that you're right. And I think that machines are already very good at anticipating what human beings desire and what would please us. They give us recommendations and they tailor our news feed and so on. And they're also very good at creating images that are fake and video clips that are also fake but will fool us. So we've seen that machines can, machines understand human psychology well enough, and they have enough artifice at this point to create things that we find compelling, even if they are fake, even if they're not real. And this, I think, could portend a world where machines understand our psychologies, they understand our emotional needs well enough, and they're clever enough about falsifying reality that they could deceive us better than the most skilled con man. And once again, you know, I sound like a broken record at this point, but once again, we have to be extraordinarily careful when we're designing systems that have these kinds of capacities, or when we're designing multiple systems that could be combined into a new system that has these kinds of capacities, because we're now off and running towards a world where machines understand us better than we do and are able to deceive us in ways that are very skilled and undetectable. And that's extremely troubling.
Yeah, so to put it another way, what we're talking about here is that we might run the risk that what we call fake news proliferates and becomes so widely believed that it's self-fulfilling, right? And so it causes panics and stock market crashes and even wars. And, you know, basically the world, the bottom falls out from the world and you don't know what to believe anymore. That's a scary, I sound like I'm being so pessimistic here, but, you know, as you said in the first show, this is something where maybe the likelihood is not that great, but the consequences are catastrophic if it occurs. So you have to really think about it.
Right. I think you're exactly right. You know, there are lots of reasons to be optimistic. There are lots of reasons to be pessimistic. And the ongoing challenge for people who are following this is just to be mindful of what how likely each of these possibilities are. So I think that there are certainly lots of reasons to be pessimistic. Let's hope that these kinds of situations that we've just contemplated are relatively unlikely.
Somewhat more on the positive side, you can see the possibility of people falling in love with their household robots, especially if they don't look like R2-D2, but they look like a good-looking human, you know, and you know, you can choose them off the shelf depending on their physical characteristics or whatever, or at least if they don't fall in love with them, and maybe they depend on them so strongly that they can't live without them and have the same kind of affection for them that we do for, say, our pets, you know, and so that would be a new phenomenon, too, that people could live alone with a robot and they wouldn't need a spouse for companionship because they have a spouse plus in their robot, right?
Yeah, that's right. Think about, even though it's very bizarre, it's another very well-known human tendency to anthropomorphize things that are not alive. We do this with our cars, right? We name our cars and we treat them well.
Yeah, it's funny. Just for example, I'm pretty objective, but back when I was young and poor, I had a Honda Accord, and that thing never needed repair. I mean, other than just change the oil and an air filter every now and then, it never broke, and I couldn't have afforded to fix it if it did. So I was really happy about it, and I used to pat the dashboard and talk to it sometimes and say, "Good car, keep going, good baby, keep on going," you know. And so I was affectionate toward it. It's funny.
And people treat robots this way too. There's stories of soldiers in the army that will have a little pack bot, which is like a little four-legged robot that follows them around and carries things for them. If those pack bots get damaged in a battle, the soldiers will want their pack bot repaired. And the army will say, well, we'll just buy you a new one. And they'll say, well, we don't want a new one. We want our old one back. We want our old one to get fixed. In the same way that if you were a child and your dog died and your parents said, well, we'll take you to the pet store and get you a new dog, you'd say, I don't want a new dog. I want my old dog back. So we form the same kinds of emotional attachments to these things that are, at the end of the day, just objects. You mentioned people that live alone with pets, and I think that's a great example, too. People find a lot of comfort. They find a lot of solace in interacting with animals like pets. And they do a lot to deaden the kind of loneliness that you might feel in that situation. Well, if robots advance to the point where they're pretty good replacements for pets, then it's not unreasonable at all to think that robots could fill that kind of emotional support niche in the lives of a lot of people. In fact, there have been some experiments in retirement homes, I believe, where they'll give people a little, I think it was a little toy seal, like a baby seal, and let them play with it. And perhaps unsurprisingly, it made a significant positive contribution to their well-being. And so I think that, you know, if you want to talk about reasons to be optimistic rather than being pessimistic, the ability of humans to form relationships with our robots could be a genuine source of reprieve and solace.
Yeah, I can see the possibility that a robot could learn enough about you to simulate unconditional love in the same way that a dog does. Not a cat, but a dog. but I won't even get into the possibility of sex with humanoid robots, which is one of the more sensational aspects that's often talked about, and that's a crazy thought, but it's just an extension of what we're saying here. Let me ask this. Do you think that with all the things we're talking about, both positive and negative, that there'll be a rising resistance to AI at some point by people, you know, out of fear or just human pride or just a sense that enough is enough. We've gone far enough. Do you think that could happen based on kind of past human history?
I think that it's very uncommon for human beings to rise up en masse against some technological development. Once technologies are invented, they're very difficult to uninvent. Take a look, for example, at the decades-long and worldwide campaign against nuclear weapons. Even after much of the world lived under the perpetual nightmare of mutually assured destruction, it's taken concerted effort on a global scale and probably the largest political organization, the largest political protest, and the largest political movement to try to get the nations of the world to disarm their nuclear weapons. And we see similar things happening with climate change. Some of the largest worldwide protests in the history of humanity, and it's been extraordinarily difficult for human beings to wean themselves off of fossil fuels. And the reason is that these technologies get invented, they ingrain themselves in our habits, and we make economic investments in them. They show us how life can be a lot more convenient and a lot easier, and we get used to them and we grow to depend on them. And that makes it very difficult to just extirpate that technology from the world after it's been invented. So I think as long as the advances in AI are taking place incrementally, as long as they're being integrated into people's lives where they're making things slightly more convenient or slightly easier here and there, and as long as people can see the benefits of them immediately in their daily lives without feeling too many of the harms, the burdens of them, I suspect that you'll find that people are happy to let AI continue on its current trajectory, at least as long as we're keeping at arm's length some of the more dystopian scenarios that we've been talking about.
I think that makes sense. Unless something really gets in their face in a very negative way across the board for many, many people at one time, people just get used to things and it becomes the new normal, right? So I think you're right. But I mean, there is the question of whether people would be able to opt out if they want to, like some people today refuse to get a smartphone or choose to live off the grid. I mean, there always are going to be people individually who want to opt out of a movement or some level of technology. So is it possible that could happen or that opt-outers even might be forced to come back into the herd? I mean, what do you think about that possibility?
Yeah, I think that that's extremely difficult and it's growing more difficult by the year, I would think, to opt out. Even if you opt out of having a smartphone, even if you just have a dumb phone or a flip phone, those phones are still generating a data trail everywhere you go. And the data that you generate is still being hoovered up by probably dozens or hundreds of corporations that want to purchase that data and feed it through their artificially intelligent systems still to anticipate your, say, your buying habits or your behaviors or your beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
So AI has already become pretty deeply rooted in just the normal business of, say, advertising and marketing and politics. It'd be very difficult to live your entire life without touching any of those systems.
Mm-hmm. Well, we just have a minute or so left, Ryan, but here's a question kind of related to all these things we've been talking about, really, but will privacy be a thing of the past? I mean, it's already becoming troublesome, you know, in the systems know more about you than they have a right to know or that you think they should know. So will privacy just become kind of a quaint old-fashioned notion that you might as well just forget about it and figure that the network knows everything about you that there is to know?
Yeah, I worry about that very deeply. And I think that one thing that you could say is that your only hope is just to be relatively obscure and uninteresting. Because if someone like a corporation or especially a state power wants to learn something about you, they definitely have the way to do it. So maybe at the end of the day, the best hope lies in reminding yourself that you're one out of 300 million people and that there are probably some more interesting people than you that that corporations or governments are interested in spying on.
Keep a low profile and be careful what you like on Facebook, I guess. You know, I mean, so I'm just going to wrap up by saying, and this is kind of pessimistic in a way, I think of technology as a blind mole that drives forward because it can without really considering consequences. And so I'll end by asking you the same thing I asked last week, if you can answer briefly, if it's possible. Are we making a deal with the devil that'll lead to the downfall of humanity as we know it? Or will AI finally lead humanity to a utopia that's free of poverty and hunger and disease and war, or somewhere in between, some muddy middle ground? What do you think?
I think the answer lies somewhere between the two of those. And hopefully with a concerted effort and some restraint and some responsible innovation informed by not just the sciences, but also the humanities, we could nudge ourselves closer to the latter, closer to the utopian vision that all of us, I think, hope for.
What do you think our listeners can do to get a better idea about that? I mean, I think that's a good answer. And, you know, you spend your professional life thinking about these things, but how can we start to think differently or act differently to kind of get a better idea of the kinds of things we've been talking about and maybe help even drive it individually toward a good outcome?
I think it's important to understand the nature of these systems, how they work, and also the ways that they're already integrated into your lives. So my suggestion would be to keep up with the news on artificial intelligence to understand the state of the art and where it might be leading us. And then I think it's also important to contact your representative about this kind of thing, because I don't think that this is the kind of problem that can be solved through individual action. It's the kind of problem that's going to require institutional change at the level of corporations or the level of governments to really tackle, because the systems that are involved here are much, much bigger than any individual person. And if, for example, Facebook has 2 billion users, then the desires or the preference or the settings that one user puts on their account are going to have a minuscule effect.
Well, that's a good place to leave it, and I think that's good advice. Thank you, Dr. Ryan Jenkins, for being on with us and talking really two times in a row about this this fascinating subject of artificial intelligence and where it's leading us and where we're leading it.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Yeah, it was great to have you on. And thanks to all of you out there for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.